Okay, part two with Tom from Durham Precious Metals. Tom was just about to tell us a story, so let's pick up where we left off. One more segment after this. There'll be a part three following this one. Okay, thanks for listening.
Go back to a farmer and his son working the farm one day. And the farmer says, go down to the general store, take this note. He writes a note, says, please give my son milk, bread, and eggs, and I will settle the debt the next time I see you. So he gives that note to his son, sends him down to the store. The store owner reads the note, gives his son the milk, bread, and eggs, and the son's walking home and he's halfway at home. At that point, when he's halfway home, who is the actual owner of the milk, bread, and eggs? And most people will say, if they think for a while, they'll say the boy. And I'll say, why? And they'll say, well, because he's in possession of it. And I'm familiar with that rule. Possession is 9/10 of the law. And that is a maxim in law. Maxims in law are things that have been sort of weighed in by court so many times, they don't question anymore. They're kind of a hard and fast rule. So possession is 9 parts of the law. And that comes from the old maxim that says no one is required to prove that they own something that they're in possession of. So in fact, let's stop there and say that it's actually kind of a trick question. Nobody really owns the property. It comes down to property rights, and property rights can be in degrees. So what is the property right of the young boy at that time? Well, possession is 9/10 of the law. So people are correct. If someone tried to steal it from him, he would have all the right to defend himself because it belongs to him and he's not required to prove it. Does he have the highest property right? And the answer is no. And we'll get into why in a minute. So the next, if I say no to that, people will say, okay, well, then it must be the store owner because he hasn't been paid yet. Well, paid is another distinction because you can't pay with debt. You can only discharge it. But he is, in fact, does not have the highest property right. He does have a property right. If the father never comes to see him, he has a piece of paper from him saying, I can exact on this in court and extract the discharge of that debt. So he does have a property right, but in fact, the strongest property right comes from the father because he issued the note and he has now divested himself through a promise of a certain amount of his labor in order to extinguish that debt. So he has the highest property right. Now, what's the difference between that note and a note that you and I write over a debt? And that's kind of the part of the story, right? Because that does illustrate just a personal transaction between people. So what's different than that note than a bank note, which is what we call currency or what we often call money? The difference is it's more universal. Those are private between two people. But in fact, they follow the same function in a sense. So the legal distinction is that they're all notes. And the language of these things matters. We'll get into the reason the language matters more. In law, things have to be very specific. Can't be any vagueness when you're trying to describe something in law and you're trying to be very specific about a rule.
Yeah, well, that's what I've been learning is how important language is. And that's a big part of why people get into trouble because they're giving up a lot of their autonomy through that language. Is that right?
Yeah, to a degree, for sure. I mean, language is an easy way to create confusion. Unless we're very specific about what we mean, I often, in debates over serious topics with people, they'll start saying something. The first thing I'll say is, well, what do you mean by that? And I'm not trying to be a smart aleck. I'm trying to get clarity. But people often get very frustrated because they've never sat and thought, what do I actually mean by that? And is that a correct term to use in that scenario? So words are extremely important when it comes down to something that's a creature of law, like currency and money. It's even more important.
Well, yeah, and we tend to have expressions about things and about money, like it'll cost you an arm and a leg. Like, do you know where that comes from?
Yeah. Where does that come from? I don't know that one, but there are a lot of those old colloquial expressions that we use. They do actually have an origin.
What I've understood with that one is that before photography was a thing, you would have your portrait painted. And you'll notice that a lot of the painted portraits are head and shoulders. So if you had an arm or a leg in your portrait, it would cost you more.
Ah, there you go. Interesting. So it does have a real meaning and a real origin. Yeah. One I can think off the top of my head is a kind of a bit of a risque one when you first hear it, but it actually means nothing. And it's freeze the balls off a brass monkey. It's actually, they used to store cannonballs on this brass fixture, and they used to stack them up in a pyramid on this thing called a brass monkey. And when it get really cold, the brass would shatter and the balls would fall off.
Wow. Who would guess?
Yeah, you know, it wasn't a sexual innuendo after all. It was just about cannonballs.
Well, that was our little interest break. You mentioned labor, that the only real unit of value is labor.
Yeah, I firmly believe that. And I guess people will debate with you all day long about that. And to me, the debates, I don't know, they don't wash to me. So my feeling on it is this. So I give this example. If you had a tract of land with unlimited minerals and resources and oil and walnut trees and all these, you know, desirable, rare things, if you just sat in a lawn chair and never did anything with it, would it have any real value? Well, it would have potential value. It would still be there waiting for you, but without the labor to actually go and get it. Because, I mean, who wants oil in the ground? It used to be considered a pollutant before we knew what to do with it. It would ooze up onto people's farmland. It'd be a curse. I got oil on my farmland. Nothing will grow there. So, you know, I keep losing my thought. This is terrible.
Well, there's so much to think about.
Yeah, so much to think about.
Walnut trees just sitting there.
Right. So if you have all this potential, but you're not willing to put any labor into it, then it really doesn't have any value, any meaningful value to anybody else. I mean, you could value the beauty of the trees and all those things are legitimate. But in terms of commerce, in terms of real usability, no value if there's no labor. Only when you decide to go and chop that tree down and cut it into boards or maybe form it into something will it be of desirable value to somebody else. Or if you could sell it to somebody else who is actually willing to do the work and the labor. So the whole point of labor is we all bring different skills. So, you know, you do your labor, I do my labor, and we have these units of currency to trade that back and forth. And that creates a more complex world with far more people doing things that they want to do, things that they're really good at, instead of, well, we've all got to feed ourselves and we do nothing but that. So money is really, or currency is what has, in my opinion, actually unleashed all this potential and this energy to take our labor and make it far more useful to others. So the whole point of the labor is that, yeah, we could do it all for ourselves, but that's very limiting. And that isn't the world we live in. We used to all be farmers and feed ourselves and take care of ourselves. And then when modern machinery came along, which was also a product of having tradability of currency so people could specialize and build that machinery. So, you know, if you follow that and trace that out, you begin to realize that we have literally built the world that we live in, good or bad. And let's not forget that it isn't all bad. It's a great world. We've done a lot of tremendous things. And all of that has been a result of being able to free up our labor to be able to do the things that we specifically are good at. And currency and gold and silver and all those various different things have helped along the way. If that answers your question.
Yeah, it's fair. I'm just looking at Christina's comments again. She says the system was created by corruption in the first place, not the other way around.
It could possibly be. If you go back in the history of it, like the most of our systems that were built came from the merchants trying to solve various different problems that they had. For example, merchants would get into great disputes because different merchants in different places of the world would have different ways of measuring things. And so when they came together, they had this real problem, this butting of heads, which would often get into some serious conflict. So by actually having the Weights and Measures Act, which was presided over by the crown or the authorities that be, that allowed peace between the traders and the merchants. And those merchants are really what built the systems, the worldwide systems of trade that we're benefiting from today. So I think the corruption comes as a byproduct later on when people say, hey, this is a great system to be able to game this and game that. And people find ways to game complex systems. And I think that's where the corruption really comes in. And that's more of a human thing and a human distinction in my mind than it is a systems distinction. So I would tend to disagree. I think the systems were started by people just simply trying to solve a real problem.
Okay, maybe I should let Christina speak on this for herself, but she's talking since the Federal Reserve was created in the 30s by seven of the wealthiest men, the oil barons, etc., at Jekyll Island in Georgia. She also says we have free energy, which has been suppressed, that would have replaced oil wells over 50 years ago, but wasn't profitable for the Rothschilds and Rockefeller bloodlines.
Well, when you get people that have benefited from a system, they're not going to want to give it up easily. And mm-hmm. it's very difficult if you have a system that's at that scale to actually change anything, because it's like trying to balance the wheels of a 18-wheeler while it's going down the highway. So it's easy to point out how corrupt the system is, and it may be, in fact, very corrupt, but I don't believe it's all that way. I think that it's a system that, like, there was a fellow that I talked to, we would talk back and forth. He was a community currency guy. And we would often say, you know, I think that this kind of system could work if that was our intent in the first place, was to make it work. I think the system has the potential to work because it does do a lot of good, but it also does a lot of bad too.
What about this whole thing with the bankruptcy in the States, and how I was just learning about this recently, and you mentioned it as well, that the United States is bankrupt, right?
Yeah, I've never been able to verify or prove any of that, but the stories do exist that bankruptcies have occurred on a scale like that. And that as a result of those bankruptcies, there's a lot of things going on that we don't fully understand.
Well, and probably Christine is just making the point, and I was just thinking that too. I mean, probably every country is. I mean, if we can't even pay off our personal debts, many people, how are we supposed to imagine that these countries that are in huge debt, and, you know, even if they didn't even have to pay interest, how on earth are they ever likely to resolve that?
Well, I mean, it's a statistical thing that if a country, for example, is in debt more than like 120% of GDP, that they've never been able to recover. Once you cross that Rubicon, that it's impossible to sort it out. And that's kind of where we're at. And I don't think that that's the system necessarily. The system is allowing it because of the way it's structured, but it's people. And I think the people, us individually, are partly responsible, although we've been, you know, albeit seduced into this consumer economy where we spend everything we have and then some. You know, we get the credit card out when that doesn't take us far enough. So really that's on us. That's on us as individuals. I know people that will, money coaches and stuff, that will tell you flat out, learn to live on 50% of what you make. How many of us do that? All right. And if you're not making enough, then figure out how to make more. I think there's blame on both sides. Certainly the system itself, you know, has its, but they're simply people that run into the same feeling, the inability to stop and say, do we have to do that? Do we have to spend that? Do we need a new XYZ or whatever, regardless of what it is? Do we need a new national park at billions of dollars, or would that money be better spent here? So I think part of it is just comes down to the human feeling of it never being satisfied. And you see it in a lot of us. It's just, it's part of our being. I don't know where it comes from or how to extinguish it, but it is something that's on all of us in that sense. And that doesn't matter to me what scale that is, whether you're just me or whether you're an international bank.
Well, it's an interesting experiment. I'm just reminded of it, of everybody takes $100 and what do you spend it on? That shows, you know, what values you have, what's important to you, whether you're contributing to somebody or just want something for yourself. And the idea of when you're paying a bill, I read this quite a while ago, the idea that you're contributing to a company, you're contributing to the families of the employees of that company. Just different ways of looking at money and how it feels and how you handle it and whether you despise it or you love it, or just the factor of how it is in a relationship with you.
I think we sort of have a love-hate relationship with it. We all need it so much and we all desire it, and everybody talks about it, and they get so excited when they have a windfall, or, you know, that's the love side of it. The hate side of it is we seem to hate it enough to want to get rid of it all the time.
Another comment here, Christine is very prolific. Okay, so this is going back to, we started talking about this maybe before she came in, about the birth certificates and how, you know, we have a registered number on our birth certificate, something to look at if you haven't looked at it. That money is made out of thin air based on borrowing. Oh, and the registered number on the birth certificate is on the stock exchange. I looked up my number the other day, but I was busy and I didn't fully investigate it, but it showed up on Google, my registration number. So I want to look further into that. Okay, so now they are trying to crash the system they created. Money is debt. We can never pay off the debt. It's not real. Okay, so now a child born into Canada comes in owing over $3,500, they come in as a debt. That's insanity. Our programming is there is not enough. So we have this programming that there's not enough money, it doesn't grow on trees, and that there's not enough to go around. But at the same time, money makes the world go around. I mean, there's all these, there was a few things that happened for me over the years where people said expressions like, oh, money sucks, I hate it. And they resented that somebody got a personalized license plate, you know, when they would do something else with what that cost. And then I gave a person some money, I mean, somebody I knew, and they crumpled it up. Like the feeling was that it wasn't enough. It would never be enough. Anyway, I started writing a list of all the expressions about money that I'd ever heard and that I kept hearing that I could remember. And I mean, it was pages and pages.
I'd like to see that list, actually.
I'd love to share it with you. Yeah, I even made a song up about it, and I wrote a story about it. Very interesting.
And we could trace out the history of all those expressions, too. That'd keep us busy for a while.
That would be a book.
Yeah. Talking about the myth busting.
Oh, yeah.
People used to say, well, the problem with that there's a shortage and all these different things with the banking system, and to their credit, they're trying to, you know, sort out what's wrong with it, the structural problems and stuff. They would often say, well, I know what's wrong. The interest is never created. They only create the principal, but they don't create the interest. That's been written and said so many times. And I thought, well, wait a minute, is that really true? So if you trace out an actual bank transaction for a car loan or a house loan, and you get into that at all, I personally believe the interest is in there, because as the model I just said earlier, I said, when you make a payment, that $2,000 payment is principal and interest. Well, there it is. There's your interest right there. It's in the payments. So the number of payments you make, a certain amount of interest is going to be factored into that over time. And if you add up the math, if you take an amortized schedule of a mortgage and add up the payments over time, you'll see that the principal and the interest are both there. So they're simply wrong. Somebody says something, nobody fact checks it and finds out if it's really real. And then we just keep repeating it because we trust the first guy that opened his mouth. Now we've got the rumor circle, you know? So I personally think that that is completely nonsense. There have been books written about this being the structural problem of money. And, you know, maybe it is, but from my investigation, I don't see that. So it's still a question in my mind of what is the actual problem. The same with money supply. People will say, well, it's money supply. They're printing too much money. Recently, they've printed, well, I always go back to this stat. If you look at 08, when it was all said and done, they bailed out to $2.7 trillion. So far, since 2019 fall, they've injected $11 to $12 trillion into the economy. And we haven't even raised a red flag that the stock market is in trouble or anything like that. So that's kind of where we're at in the money supply. But where's the inflation? Well, we're starting to see it now, but that's more of a product of us not producing as much, right? Because if you have very few goods and a lot of money chasing it, sooner or later, people are going to find out they can bid up to get that thing, that rare thing that's becoming more and more rare all the time. And so begins the arms race of inflation. So money supply is only one factor of it. But some people will, you know, argue tooth and nail, it's all money supply. And my question is then, what is the right money supply? If we can't get that right, if we've been arguing about that for 100 years and can't get that right, maybe we're arguing about the wrong thing. Maybe it isn't just money supply. And there, obviously, there are scholars who will talk, and that Jim Rickards is one who always repeats that. He goes, money supply alone cannot cause inflation. It requires money velocity, or it requires that money to move. But are those the only factors? Honestly, I think it goes even beyond that. It goes deeper than that. Obviously, production and things like that factor into it. But it's very complex. So I'm not sure that this is a thing that can be solved from the top down, but they keep trying. You know, really, these big central banks only have two tools in the toolbox. They have interest rates and money supply. That's a pretty small toolbox for a system that the whole world relies on. So clearly, there's something about this system that doesn't function. But again, it partially functions and it makes a lot of people a lot of profits. So there's not an incentive, big enough incentive to change it.
Again, it's coming back to that idea that we're fish in water. We don't know what else we're in. Like, exactly. I mean, we don't know what else could work or what could be better or, you know, what is actually going on with what we're familiar with. We're gradually waking up to things now, and it's disorienting. Like mm-hmm. The thought that the bank is where you put your money and you get numbers in, you know, and you want lots of numbers in there and you want to stock some of it away and or sock some of it away in stocks. So the idea that maybe that's not the best idea, that actually once you give the money to the bank, you're giving the money to the bank and they consider it theirs and they want to know what you're going to do with it if you take out too much of it. And like, as if.
Yeah.
Just all those kind of things that start making you go, well, maybe there's a different way to be managing. Like, are we giving it all away? Like literally even our autonomy, you know, it's not just the physical or the numbers of it, but are we giving away our responsibility?
Yeah, that's a big question. You know, I've been very frustrated at times in my life about the way the system works, and particularly when it affects you negatively. And I've complained and complained, but I still come around to the fact that we as individuals have to become more savvy and more aware, or it will always be that way. A lot of it is on us. If we'd understood these systems as they were developing, when, you know, people that were taking advantage of the system and gaming it to set it up a certain way that advantaged them to our disadvantage, we'd have recognized it earlier and been able to kill the monster while it was small. Now it's become this Leviathan that even the people that are in charge of it don't know what to do with it. It's become such a disaster and such a mess that they're, you know, practically ready to throw it in the dustbin and start over again, you know. And that's kind of seems like where we're at right now. There's no way to fix it. It's a broken mechanism. So now what, right? And I don't think the system believes it either. And that's why I don't think they've tried even to fix it since 08. I think what they've been trying to do is figure out how to migrate to a different system.
Well, and migrate all of us with them somehow to their advantage still. She says it's the two tools, like you mentioned, the two tools that they don't want to give up. And if the country claims bankruptcy, see who owns those RSPs and other assets like land and houses. And, you know, I mean, that's why right now, I mean, my sense of it, not that I have a place to sell, but my sense of it is this is a really good time to sell, not necessarily a good time to buy.
Yeah, if you're talking real estate.
Yeah, well, actually, I guess it would depend what you were buying, because I think the feeling is that land and having your own property is a good idea, like out of the city. But if you have a house, you're probably going to realize the value of that better by selling it right now than trying to buy something that you might not be able to ever sell. I guess it depends what you need and what you're looking at.
Yeah, again, it's for something like that, it's an individual thing.
Yeah.
If you look at land, I mean, land is, you know, they often say the same thing. They say they're not making any new land. So, I mean, land has always been a good asset. I think right now, I'm by no means a real estate expert, but I don't think you have to be a real estate expert to see the structural problems in real estate. And particularly in Canada, because we really don't have a typical economy in Canada. We're a very, very big country. We're very spread out. And we live in a cold climate where housing is really important. When it gets to the middle of February, you know, it's nice to come home, snuggle up by the fireplace. So people have put a lot of their emphasis into housing. And so we have this huge asset bubble in housing right now, clearly. Where that's headed, nobody knows. But personally, I think the forces within the real estate industry itself, the closed forces within there, are less relevant to where real estate is going than a credit crisis. Because if you have a credit crisis, well, obviously, credit is a major factor in housing, so that could all come to a bitter end very quickly. Canada Mortgage Housing Corporation, I read a stat, a headline, looked into it about a year and a half ago, and they had stated that they believed by 2030 that in one potential scenario, not all of them, but one potential scenario, housing values could drop up to 50%. That's pretty aggressive for an institution like that to be talking 8-9 years out with those numbers. So that's a real cause for concern to look at that number if you're a homeowner.
Well, yeah, but at the same time, if you're not a homeowner, you might think, wow, that's the time to get into the market, right?
Well, this is it. And there are some gurus in the gold and silver industry. Mike Maloney comes to mind, and he'd be the first to say, I don't love shiny pieces of metal. I just don't see anywhere else to be right now that's a good place to be. And he personally thinks real estate will go down and metals will go up and create what he calls a golden cross, where swapping metals for real estate or land will be the right thing to do, because then you won't get trapped in this up and down valuation channel. You ride your asset up to the top of the channel and then you leapfrog from there into a new asset that's undervalued and keep on going instead of riding it down and then riding it back up. That's the model that he believes in. And well, that's a model of value investors, really. If you talk to value investors that are buy and hold value type investors, that's the strategy they use. They look for undervalued assets, ride them up till they're near the top, get out of that, move into something else that's undervalued, and just keep on going. And that's how true wealth is made.
That's not something I know too much about, but that's really talking about the stock exchange, right? Which is hard to say how that's all going to go, because that's traditionally what they say is to stay in it and take the ups and downs. What about cryptocurrency and Bitcoin? Do you have any thoughts about that?
Yeah, well, Bitcoin started out to be, I mean, a lot of people don't understand what Bitcoin is. So I'll do a little quick thing on Bitcoin for those who don't understand it. There's a good talk from a fellow named Andreas Antonopoulos about this, where he talks about how Bitcoin actually functions, what's under the hood. And it's actually three existing technologies that created Bitcoin. And one of them is BitTorrent, the file sharing that they, you know, Napster and all those things where they were doing file sharing through BitTorrent. Well, BitTorrent is the basis of Bitcoin.
Oh.
Now, another thing called Hashcash, which was a little code that a fellow created for people were using bots. You can create these computer bots that will surf around the web and do work for you. And typically what they do is they do spam. So people were using these bots to spam forums, to build links in forums. So this guy created this little technology called Hashcash, which was part of what we see now with CAPTCHAs, when you have to fill out a CAPTCHA. So what they did with that was they created that so that bot would have to do a little bit of math work before it could post on the forum. And since a bot can post in a nanosecond, for it to have to take 5 seconds to do that calculation really slowed it down a lot, and it prevented a lot of spamming. That is another function of Bitcoin. It's actually the proof of work part of Bitcoin. The other part of it is a thing called the SHA-256 computer algorithm, which for every small change in input, it makes a massive 64-character digital footprint that's radically different. So you can change something like a 0.1% here, and it'll change this radically on this end. So it allows the randomness of code on the other end. And those three technologies working together is what Bitcoin is. Mm-hmm. The challenge with Bitcoin is people have tried and tried and tried to make it a good transaction layer, but it can only do 8 transactions a second. Its main feature is its security, right? It's unkillability, right? So every effort that their developers make to improve upon it, to go from 8 transactions to 16 to 20, ruins the security function. So you have this, you know, this is what it was designed for. So people have, over time, over the 9 years, figured out that Bitcoin is a far better store of value. Now, those are all the positive sides of it, and it is being used for that. Institutions are lining up to invest in it. But the challenge is it only has a 9-year track record. It is a digital system, and it also requires onboarding. So it may be autonomous on its own and unkillable, but the on-ramps are the weak points. And of course, those can be regulated and controlled. So for me personally, I have a little bit of Bitcoin because I think it's important to be part of that ecosystem for no other reason than it is the future. Blockchain is probably part of our future in terms of transactional finance. I don't believe Bitcoin will be it, but it's a good gateway to learning about blockchain, to actually owning it and understanding it and navigating the systems that are going to be in place. I think it's more of an educational position than it is a financial position for me.
Do you think that it might have been a more secure way for, like, for example, the people in Ottawa who just did some stuff there? Do you think that it might have been more secure for them than the way they were fundraising?
No. They have a technology now called Chainalysis, which can actually look and follow transactions online and trace them back to their origin, to the device ID or to your IP address.
Right.
There is no anonymity. The only thing that it does afford you is the ability to dump it onto a cold wallet and hide it and say, you can't take this from me. But I mean, how good is it going to be to anybody if they can't transact with it later on? As soon as they put it online, it runs into one of these roadblocks that they've created. So I think that it's going to be a bit bumpy for a while for blockchain, but I think eventually it will become a pretty important technology down the road.
Part of my consideration of it is that it is online, and that in itself feels vulnerable. Like, it's intangible. It's not like something in hand.
Yes, exactly. It doesn't have the history. Now, I don't know, that may or may not matter, but for me, it matters. Something that stood up for 5,000, 6,000 years like gold and silver have, when push comes to shove, I'm going to put a lot more of my bet on that over a technology that I can't see, feel, or touch.
Yeah, I agree with that. So we've been talking for about an hour, and Christina's been very talkative on the chat. And I'm wondering if anybody has a burning question that they would like to ask Tom.
I do know a couple things I do want to cover after I do a couple questions, and sure. It just occurred to me I should cover some things about silver and gold that aren't necessarily covered very often.
Yeah, and I wanted to just ask, you've had a shop, Durham Precious Metals, for a short time, but you were somewhere else before that, right?
Yeah, we've been in business 8 years now.
8 years, okay. All right, yes, carry on then. And if anybody has, does anybody have anything they want to ask at this juncture? Listening. Okay, I don't see any questions.
Okay, I don't see any. Okay, so I'll carry on with my what I was going to talk about there. So I have a lot of conversations with new people that are coming and buying silver and gold. And so being that there aren't social cues out there coming from everywhere like there are with other things to tell people what to do, they feel very vulnerable and very confused. And they almost don't even know what to ask to start out. So I'm going to clear up a couple things about and take away some of the layers of complexity. So if you go out to the web and you listen to various different gurus talk about gold and silver right now, they'll have a lot to say. And a lot of it's true and probably relevant depending on who you are. But remember, these people have to create content every day or every week to keep these channels going. So they're going to add layers of complexity that may not be relevant to you. So I like to simplify gold and silver down to this. It's really like, I used to have a fellow that came into our store. He was a regular buyer, and his wife used to give him a hard time. His name was Mike. And he would laugh, and he'd said to me something that I just laughed. He goes, she'd say, you're spending money on that. And he goes, no, I'm not. I'm trading one kind of money for another. And I thought, that's brilliant. It's not like you're going down and buy a TV that's going to end up a landfill site one day. So really all you do is, you're swapping 20s for 100s in a sense, right? So there's that. And it never even dawned on me being in the business to frame it that way, all right, until he said it. So that's one thing. The other thing people get confused on is which is better, silver or gold. So I'll speak to that. Neither. They're both perfectly good. Push come to shove, close your eyes and point and you'd be fine with either. The real considerations come down to bulk. So for example, a person asked me the other day, said, if I buy $50,000 in silver, how much is it going to weigh? And I said, that's a good question. So I did the calculation. I said, well, it's going to weigh about as much as I do, about 180 pounds. So that's an awful lot of bulk. So the question is, do you have a place to store that much bulk? If you had to move it, are you able to carry that? Is that too much? So those are factors, and increments are factors too. I have another analogy that I recently came up with that, because we have anything from fractional instruments down as small as we have these, we don't sell them, but these Valcambi bars that are, these tiny little fractional silver that you can break off, right? And
oh yeah.
And we have a product by Royal Canadian Mint called a Maple Gram, which is a tiny little wee, looks just like a Royal Canadian Mint gold maple, but it's about that big. It's about a quarter inch, very, very small. So there's those. So increments matter, because my analogy is this. If you were going on an extended vacation for a year and all you could take with you was cash and you knew that nobody was going to be able to make change, what increments would you take with you? You'd take dimes, quarters, dollar, $2 bill, five, because you're not going to get change. Well, not that you wouldn't get change from gold and silver, but it's sort of the same thing. If later down the road you want to divest yourself of a bit and cash it in, if you only have big increments, you're going to be having to cash in a lot. And let's say silver and gold go to astronomical numbers, which some predict they will. That would be an awful lot of a commitment to cash in at once. You might not want that. So having a number of different increments is probably the most important thing, really, to consider. Just use that analogy of going on a trip and not being able to get change, and that'll hold you in good stead. Mm-hmm. So those are the main considerations. And if you reduce the simplicity of it down to that, almost everything else pales in comparison, in my opinion.
Those are really good points, Tom. And I also think in terms of like going to a farmer's market, you wouldn't go with a $100 bill to a farmer's market. That's not doing anybody any favors. Like, you want to take small bills because that's what's going to be circulating and be of value to everybody.
And if you'd have asked me 10 years ago, do you think people will be trading silver for goods at some point? And I'd have said, probably not. They'll probably bring it back to a bullion dealer or wherever they happen to be and trade it in for cash. But I'm beginning to think that that could be a real possibility, because if the systems break down even temporarily, I mean, they don't have to break down forever. They only have to break down for a couple months to cause a lot of devastation. And having something for a transaction could make the difference between eating or getting gas in your car or getting across a border. You know what I mean?
You know, because things are quite turbulent right now and have been for a while increasingly, you know, there has been a lot of attention to different modes of value and thinking of things that may not even be of value to me, but would be of value to somebody else and having some of those on hand. There's a different kind of feeling of wealth. It's not all about money. It's about what you can offer as service or items that somebody might need. So silver is certainly an affordable way. And I love that what you said, that it's that you're trading money for money. That's brilliant.
Yeah, I give credit to Mike for that one. That wasn't mine.
Yeah. What else have we got here? Did you have another myth to bust at all?
Yeah, Nixon took us off the gold standard in 1971. No, he did not. He closed the international convertibility window. We were off the gold standard in 33.
Okay. This is very interesting because, yeah.
Well, they made it illegal to own it in 33. That pretty much ended the gold standard right there.
And so how did that look? What do you mean illegal to own it? They recalled it or?
Yeah, they actually told people in the U.S. to cash in their, they revalued it from $35 down to $20 an ounce and told people that they had to cash it in and take currency. Now, most people didn't comply back then. And we know that because a lot of those gold coins that existed prior to that are still being recirculated today. So clearly they didn't cash them in for melt. All right. So most people didn't comply, but it was an order that came down.
Wow. Oh, Christina's got a comment. That was a corrupt move. They made people into the gold backing up the money. We are still the gold.
Yeah, kind of in a way. Yeah. But the question is a gold standard the ultimate standard? I'm a big fan of gold, but a gold standard is a different thing. It's still just a backing for currency. So here's the thing. If it's a backing for currency, isn't it a limited backing? Because yeah, some people will argue that, well, gold will, because it takes effort to mine, it takes time, it's going to slow down the progress of development, which in a way it would. So is gold truly the proper standard to have to back up a currency? I don't know. I mean, it's probably for smarter people than me to debate about, but it is a good question. We just presume, well, we need to go back to a gold standard. It's another one that people pound on all the time. And I go, well, have you thought this through? I mean, gold would create a very limiting factor. I mean, if we go back to times in history, we go back to the Great Depression. It was a lack of money that was the problem. It was a lack of currency that was the problem. And how would gold change that? It really wouldn't. You know, the gold was still there. So why couldn't they just create the currency that was needed to lubricate the economy to move it forward? Good question, right? So A lot of these things, I think we just accept at face value because we're often too lazy to go do the deep dive work and go beyond that and say, well, maybe this so-called expert, that's just an opinion. Just because he lived a long time ago and, you know, had a nameplate and a big office doesn't mean that he's right or she's right.
What you just said there made me think of, what was that you said? Holding up something as an idea without believing it. DurhamPreciousMetals.com.
Anybody who has questions, feel free to call. Don't sit in the dark and do what some people have done and call me up and tell me you've been waiting 2 years to do this. Call me up and talk to me and let me walk you through it and buy an ounce of silver and take it home. And just get it in your hand and go home and just go through the experience. It's not a lot. All the things that you thought were a big deal don't even exist.
Yeah, more questions than answers. That's the truth.